listening to Nights and Weekends. I'm your host, Lee Pacquia. All right. Welcome to August, folks. Hope you're all doing okay out there. Big show coming up for you this week. Two interviews. First up, man, this rules. We have David Roth, formerly of Deadspin. David is a writer covering all things related to sports, and he's also a podcast guy, best known for his work at a blog called Deadspin. The podcast was called Deadcast, RIP. For those of you who don't know, Deadspin used to be a really awesome website that covered sports, politics, and culture. It was one of the few pages that I'd actually go to on the internet to read most of what they published. I loved it. It was around for many, many years. And then, well, they had a, massive hiccup back in the fall of 2019 when the private equity owners told staff that they had to narrow their scope of coverage to just sports. No culture, no politics, no shenanigans, just sports. To do pretty much the opposite of everything that made them great in the first place. The staff revolted, and after a quick falling out, they resigned en masse, David included, just walked off the job. Not something you see often in the digital media space, where full-time gigs are extremely hard to come by. The core Deadspin staff took some time, and a couple of weeks ago, they announced that they are forming their own publication, this time employee-owned. It's called Defector. It launches in the fall of 2020, and we are thrilled to get to talk to David about what comes next. After that, we're going to be checking in again with epidemiologist and health economist Eric Fagel-Ding. Eric is a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, and in this time of COVID, he is an absolute must-follow on Twitter for his breakdowns of news and research related to the pandemic. He was one of the first people on Twitter to start sounding the alarm over the coronavirus, and he's just a tremendous resource. But first, we're going to be talking to David. Enjoy. David, thank you for joining us today. Welcome to the program. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Can't complain. You know, another day in paradise. So wanted to start off at the top here just by asking you, why did you guys do this to yourselves? Who starts a business in the middle of a global pandemic?
Only true wizards and geniuses would take on such a decision for themselves. It was never going to be easy, obviously. There's something kind of bracing about having picked the worst possible moment at which to do it. You know, it's like you want to play against the best. But it's something that we'd been talking about basically from the moment that we left Deadspin on Halloween of 2019. And so it's just been going back and forth and trying to find the best possible way to do this very difficult and ill-advised thing. And, you know, I'm happy with what we settled on. Like, it seems like, and, you know, the initial response has been good. Like, I really do think that there's people that want this website. Obviously, we want this website. It is just like a real strange thing to be like asking people for money at this moment. Yeah. But people have responded with money, so maybe I should get over that.
No, I mean, it seemed like the initial reception to you guys doing this was overwhelmingly positive. So yeah, as I said in the intro, you guys have a really unusual situation here. After basically everyone resigned en masse, you and your colleagues had a lot of time away from the project, months and months. I mean, this was back at Halloween of last year. Did that time spent wandering the desert lead, at least on your end personally, to any philosophical takes on what you guys built at Deadspin? Things Absolutely. You would have done differently, stuff like that? Or was it all about, we got to get back to the main task, you know, singularly focused on that?
I think a little bit from column A and a little bit from column B. You know, we never stopped hanging out in like a Slack channel. It just stopped being attached to a website, you know, but like we're all like as broken by like blogging stuff as you could possibly be. And so when we saw things that were stupid or when we saw things that we thought would make an interesting story, everybody was sharing links and talking about it. And it was the same sort of culture that we had, you know, at the site. You know, like we would get to, especially, you know, now with the pandemic sort of forcing everyone indoors, like we did, you know, like Zoom trivia and like Jeopardy and stuff like that. Like we stayed together, and that really did like reinforce for me how important it was, you know, if we could do it, for me to continue working with these people, just because I really do like them. And, you know, I think writing for other sites, like I had some really good experiences freelancing, and like I'm probably going to stay freelancing because we're not going to be paying ourselves until we can. So I'll still be getting up where I can. But having a home, you know, where you sort of understand the internal culture and everybody gets everybody else, and you can sort of work with editors that know your, you know, your tics and your tendencies, that's like a really, you know, for a writer, it's a valuable thing. But I think also like it made me think about it as in the way that sort of a reader might, that there's like a lot of the internet that I used to just sort of go to a page and scroll down and read what looked interesting. A lot of those sites don't exist anymore. And in many ways, Deadspin was kind of the last of those sites.
Mm-hmm.
And in the absence of that, like it pointed out to me more, I think, and you know, other people said as much to me, that like there's still a place for sites like that. That people, it's not like people stopped wanting to read the internet that way. It just stopped being economically viable, you know, according to the people that own websites, for such sites to exist. And I don't think that that's necessarily true.
Hmm. Is anyone on the masthead going to be doing this as their full-time gig?
Oh yeah, I mean, we all will be when we can. It's basically like we have some understanding of what we're going to need to get to the point where we're able to pay everybody something like the salaries that we were getting before. And we're off to a good start, but it's like, you know, it's a process. But the idea is that, like, you know, we work at this and get it there, as opposed to, you know, this is the difference between like if we had gotten money pre-launch, then maybe we all are able to start at that salary, but then we're beholden to the person whose money we have.
Yeah. No, I think as a, from a business operations standpoint, I think that that's going to be when things start to get really, really interesting. As a fan of the site, I'm thrilled you guys are coming back. And like you said, I'm going to have a website again that I can go to every day and check in on what's happening. But nice. Just kind of watching the project from afar as people start to tick over from, you know, part-time to full-time, that's just going to be a fascinating, fascinating experiment. Because, I mean, look, you guys are an employee-owned digital media company operating in a very challenging environment. It's going to be really cool to see this unfold.
Yeah. I mean, it's exciting for us too. I mean, it's harrowing, obviously, like just because of the fact that, you know, for all the things that, like, when you get a staff job, like, especially now, you basically know that it's like, at least from my experience, that you're going to have that job for about 2 years before things start to get bad, you know, and you either get pivoted out of existence or, you know, there's some sort of reorg and shakeup and all that. It's just the way that the industry works right now. And in this case, it's like, you know, and there's some certainty to that, but it's like you're just sort of like looking for another lifeboat to swim to when yours goes down. Mm-hmm. In this case, like we really are trying to build something that will last, that will be like our home. But like the risk of it is, it's much more on the front side of it. You know, it's going without for a little while, but we are all clear in terms of what we're willing to put up with, you know, in the months ahead in order to get something that we can keep.
Yeah. No, I think that that environment that you described where people would just kind of jump from lifeboat to lifeboat in kind of a sea of turmoil, that was the state of play from an employee standpoint in digital media for years and years. And it kind of feels to me like that cycle is starting to get old. And I wasn't quite sure how or when things were going to change. But after talking to Alexander Chan at Discourse Blog and now you with the Deadspin reboot, I think we are going to start to see more and more of these new projects start to coalesce and find a new way through the wilderness. I know you've been over this in countless interviews, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. But man, looking back on the demise of Deadspin, what a circus. I don't think I've ever seen a business owner just torch a productive asset quite like the way the private equity firm did with Deadspin. I don't really even have a specific question on this point. I'm just in awe every time I think about it. More time, more water under the bridge here. More time has gone by. Has your view of what specifically happened changed over time, or do you still view it the same way you did back then?
I mean, I think I'm as confused by it as I was just for the reason that you said that. It just didn't, it was 100% a choice on ownership's part. And, you know, I've been at places where, you know, like maybe they took more venture money than was wise, or maybe, you know, in the case of Vice, it was like this bizarre Potemkin pump and dump sort of enterprise that like was never really about the product. In this case, you didn't really have to do anything, and he chose to do something. That it's like that.
It wasn't weird, early economic motivation.
No, I mean, it wasn't. It was the sort of thing where, like, economically, I think, you know, there's little like trims and moves that you could make. But this was not about that. I mean, I think that this was, it felt, and I think I haven't seen anything that would change this. Like, it felt sort of personal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the thing that made it seem, I think, for all of us in terms of leaving, made it clear that was actually what we sort of needed to do, that like it was unworkable and it was not going to become more workable. Mm-hmm. Because that wasn't, I mean, it didn't need to get bad in the first place. That was a thing that, you know, ownership sort of opted into. And so for there, it's just a matter of like, do you leave on your own terms or do you wait for, you know, that moment to be manufactured upstairs? Mm-hmm. And it wound up being, I mean, it's a very difficult choice. I've never really quit a job in my life, but this was something that, you know, at the time, it was less difficult than you'd think. I mean, it was really just like, it was clear that what we had made was shrinking, and that at one point or another, there just wouldn't be room for us in it.
So looking ahead, Defector is, you're poised to launch in September, which is supposed to be one of the best times of the year for sports in the United States. NFL and college football is supposed to come back. Baseball is supposed to start to get interesting. European soccer kicks off. That said, I'm not entirely convinced in 2020 we're going to see much in the way of pro sports in America, at least not this fall.
Yep.
If I'm right, what the hell are you guys going to cover?
Well, this is where I think we actually have a decent proposition here, which is that like we were always good at covering sports even when there wasn't sports, you know, that like the big games and stuff definitely drove traffic. I mean, we were like every other site in that regard. Mm-hmm. But like we don't need the Super Bowl to write about football necessarily. It helps, but I think that like because of the fact that we're defining this sort of in the way that Deadspin defined itself, you know, that there's more to it than just covering the sports themselves as they happen. And then because it's a subscription site, we don't need to be like, we'll be covering, you know, things that are happening, whatever it is that's happening in September, but like we don't need to be like churning highlight posts or anything like that, because that's not what people are paying us for.
Right. That's a very good point. And
yeah,
maybe I'm wrong. Basketball kicked off last night, and unlike baseball, they seem to have their act together.
I think that the bubble stuff could actually work.
Did you watch the games last night? What'd you think of the NBA relaunch?
I was, so I thought it was extremely heartening, but also in the way that like all of the sports coming back has been, there's like something really stilted and upsetting about it. Like the fans appearing via Zoom in the background of scenes was very like Tron Legacy vibes, like not what you're looking for necessarily in a televised sporting event. But, it seems like they figured out a way to do it without the players getting sick, which is basically, you know, to me, the most important consideration with any of this. I mean, it's weird. I wouldn't think that athletes would necessarily want to sign up to like just live in a hotel for months on end and only go to work and, you know, then go back home and like play video games. But also, like, for one, what do I do? And two, like, if it works and they're not sick, then like maybe that's what it is. I mean, the baseball thing to me has been way harder to watch. So I'm so excited to have baseball back, and I really wanted it to feel right, and it doesn't. And so there's this long sort of like declining negotiation going on in terms of like, when are we going to come to grips with the fact that it isn't working?
Mm-hmm.
But with the NBA, I mean, like it worked. I don't know if you've followed this, there's something called the basketball tournament that is like $1 million winner take all thing. They've done it for a few years, and they did a bubble first, and those games were on ESPN. And like when you're really fiending for sports, when you're like scraping in between the cushions, like looking for anything that is like sports adjacent, the basketball tournament was pretty tight. It was like guys that had played you know, college basketball at big programs sort of coming together to compete for this prize. It ended with like a game-winning Travis Diener three-pointer that won a bunch of Marquette alums the $1 million. But they successfully pulled off a bubble. And while there was a lot of like, you know, kind of patting themselves on the back in the broadcast, I remember watching it and being like, this seems like it sucks, but also like, it seems like it could work. And I've never seen from MLB or NFL any indication that they've put nearly as much thought into that.
Yeah. I mean, we had a couple of shows ago, we had George Shea on. He's one of the owners of Major League Eating, and he's the guy in the straw hat running around the stage at the hot dog contest. Well,
that really pins it down for me.
Yeah.
A huge fan. Love the hat.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and he's an absolute riot. But, you know, talking to him, I mean, they put on the event. They staged it for ESPN. They pulled it off. And we talked to him about the experience, and it was really fucking hard. And they were able to do it, but they have a very small footprint. It's like putting on an NBA game, at least with personnel on the floor and around the floor. It's more like an NBA game than a Major League Baseball game. We're talking about much fewer people. Looking at how, I mean, the NBA obviously can do it better because there's 10 people on the floor. You have coaches, you have some other stuff, but it's nowhere near the size of a footprint of a Major League Baseball game. Looking at how various leagues have struggled with this, I don't see any way the NFL is going to make this work in the fall. I mean, there's just too many people that need to be on the field. Too much needs to go into supporting, you know, the event of an NFL game. It just doesn't seem workable to me.
I think that that's probably right. But I also think that the one way you can guarantee that it won't work is if you just ignore that, which seems to be what MLB did. And it seems very much like the NFL response, just based on the way that they handle all of this stuff. Like, to me, if you wanted to do it, like if you did a bubble in Southern California, say that, like, and you have, I mean, there you have the Rose Bowl, you've got two NFL stadiums, you know, there's, it could be made to work. You'd have to do the games on days other than Sundays. But like, if you're willing to be serious about it and try to come up with something new, then maybe you can do it. Mm-hmm. If you're not, or if your understanding of what it means to be serious is simply to be like, we need this, therefore we're going to do it, and you treat it like the government trying to get businesses to reopen, then like, you're just going to make people sick and it's going to flop. And either you're going to get a lot of people hurt or you're going to fail. I guess those two things are not really distinct from each other, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I think it's all about an organization's ability to pivot. And I think that professional sports, you know, at least in the United States, they don't deal with change necessarily very well.
Yeah. There's also the question of the context of it too, you know, that like there, for all the things that, like, for instance, like the Premier League seems to have gotten right, or that like Bundesliga got right, it helps to be in a country where the pandemic is successfully being suppressed. Like in this case, you shouldn't have to do a bubble to make this work, but that is absolutely the only thing that you could do, because it's uncontrolled spread in like half the, you know, states. Like the idea of like the entire NFC West being played in the middle of like, you know, deep red upticks in, you know, this virus, like, it's terrible to think about.
Yeah. We're here with David Roth, back after this. And we're back. David, when we do get back to some level of normalcy, I feel like sports in America is going to be a little bit different. As we've seen, the NFL has totally eaten shit on the Kaepernick thing. Dan Snyder is going to have to finally change the name of the Washington, D.C. football team. Cleveland's Major League Baseball franchise is also probably going to be forced to rebrand here. Looking at stuff like this from 35,000 feet, does that make for a trend in professional sports? Is something bigger at play here, or is this just organizations reacting to, you know, very specific issues they should have dealt with a long time ago?
I think it's contextual. There's no way Dan Snyder might wind up changing the name of his football team. He will never think that it's the right thing to do. I mean, that's just, Dan Snyder is a special case. Of course, I'm a huge fan of his work. And we're personal friends, of course. But the, like, a lot of this stuff, that's the part of it that I think is kind of like interesting to me, because there's this trend in the like sort of the way that sports gets talked about, where they're like, oh, the NBA is like, it's, you know, real politically astute or whatever. And it's not that it's not politically attuned or like opinionated or whatever. It's that like it's a corporation. It's no more capable of having politics than like GlaxoSmithKline is. You know, that like what they're doing is like assessing the national mood and responding to the concerns of their, you know, this group of people that are both its labor, but also the product that they're selling. Mm-hmm. And responding accordingly. And like, I think that's more encouraging. The idea that somehow like owners or teams or leagues are growing a conscience, I just think is like, it's a category error. Like that's not what leagues do. Mm-hmm. But if they will go where they're led though. And so in this case, it's like, if it's clear that players are going to stand up for their rights as people, and it's clear that the people that are watching it care about that and want to see them recognized as such, then they'll do that. And I think that, like, you know, the NFL's calculation with Kaepernick was that he was out, you know, over his skis, and that like basically that what their base wanted was to reject him. And I think that like now it seems clear that, you know, obviously there's some exceptions and it is still, you know, I think a fan base that skews conservative. But I think that like at this point, it's clear that like you can't just do that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you brought up the notion that the NBA is a little bit more corporatized than some of the other pro leagues, which, you know, by and large seem to be cabals of small family run businesses that have outsized cash and influence. Yeah.
It's weird. You wouldn't think that would be preferable, but then like, yeah, compare anything to MLB right now and you're like, oh yeah, I can see the merits of that.
Yeah.
Bunch of like creepy finance guys and like quarter zip fleeces. Like I'll take it. I'll take that over the Ricketts family for sure.
For sure. But you know, having people like the Ricketts and the Dan Snyders of the world, it makes your job easy because they're bumbling mistake prone, you know, headline machines. Yeah. I'm kind of wondering here if we're going to see some of these other pro leagues try to catch up with the NBA and corporatize themselves, you know, especially faced with such a challenging operating environment here. I mean, screw ups here are going to be really costly. Like you can't just, you know, act the way the Ricketts family has or the Snyder family has and continue to expect to do things. I mean, Nike dropped carrying the apparel of the Washington DC football team. That hurts. You can't screw around like this anymore. And I'm wondering if a logical extension of that is going to be people are going to grow up.
I would sure love to see it, but I will believe it when I see it. I mean, I think that especially for I don't think that MLB owners appreciate how dire their situation is right now and like how important it is that they stop fucking up. I mean, there's no evidence that they do understand that. And, you know, if and when this season fails, you know, then you've got next year and then you have an expiring collective bargaining agreement, which the owners have already signaled that they want to go hard as hell on and are willing to lock the players out. Like they really could kill the sport. Mm-hmm. Like I think that the game itself is healthy. Interest in it is healthy. Like everybody's making money. They just can't stop messing with it. And I think that, you know, because there's these like guaranteed sort of TV deals, and I think that's a bubble, but it is a lot of money for them. I think that they really believe that like they can't screw it up and they have to press their advantage just on principle, you know, over labor, because that's like what rich people think they should do. I think that like the risk is much higher than they know. I mean, I think it's the same thing with NFL and sort of the way that they have handled the, you know, the brain trauma issue over the last half a decade, that like they are maybe beginning to appreciate that it is real, but they also have that kind of like, I remember this was like a thing during the bubble, the last of the big like sort of crash thing. These like people, the subprime shit, people mm-hmm. being like, oh, well, they knew that this stuff was sketchy, but I'll be gone, you'll be gone. You know, it was like what traders used to say to each other. Like by the time it blows up, everybody's going to be on their boat. Mm-hmm. And I think that owners have that sense that like, you know, whenever the reckoning comes, whenever like baseball's decline starts to look more like a collapse, or whenever the NFL really is faced with like a shortage of people willing to play football, that, like, by that point, you know, everybody's already cashed out and they're doing all right. I don't know if they are correct about where that day is.
Well, I think it's been accelerated here.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sitting in my house with a one-year-old. I really love Italian soccer, but now ESPN through the ESPN Plus app gets me every game played in Italy. You know, I'm just going to sit down and watch that instead of baseball or football because, you know, they can't operate as usual here. But soccer's putting a better product on the field at the moment. And yep. I mean, if baseball and football wasn't worried about, you know, losing market share out to those guys to begin with, now they've got a real problem on their hands. And they also have esports to contend with. I mean, there's still stuff happening and they're going to get left in the dust here if they don't figure this out.
Yeah. But to me, this is the thing that's weirdest about baseball, especially, is that the commissioner, Rob Manfred's been there forever, but was always like a hammer for the owners in previous scenarios. Like, that's sort of what commissioners do. But when he was working under Selig, it was the same deal. The thing that's striking about him, and I think is also true about a lot of the owners, is that, like, all of the tweaks and the stuff that they talk about, you know, some of it is the usual, like, sort of unconvincing claims of losing money or, you know, crying poverty at strategic moments. But there's also a lot of evidence that suggests that maybe they just don't like baseball very much. Mm-hmm. That so much of what Manfred talks about, you know, making games shorter, tweaking this and that, and, like, it's not about the stuff that, you know, you'd imagine a commissioner would want, which is to basically wring more TV money out of it for the owners and to limit the amount of that that goes to the players. Like, they really are messing with the product in a way that suggests that they think it's bad. And I don't think that that's what the problem is with the league. I think that the issue that they have is that there's, like, attitudinally, baseball is not fun in the way that it should be. And that's not the result of, like, games taking too long. It's the fact that it has, like, a crappy, sour vibe around it. And that for years, the owners have been, you know, engaged in this weird sort of capital strike where players are concerned, so that it doesn't even always seem like teams are trying to win.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fascinating that you bring that up, because as Americans are watching more and more European soccer, one of the things that I think a lot of people coming from an American perspective find so alluring about European soccer, if you're in the bottom three or four of your league at the end of the season, you get kicked down to the minor leagues, which I think makes it way much more fun. Like, yeah, you know, at the top level, you're trying to figure out who's going to win the league or who's going to qualify for, you know, the super special tournaments at the end of the year, but also to be watching, like, you know, the Baltimore Oriole equivalents, you know, fighting for, you know, their very survival up to the end of the season, way more compelling. Way more compelling. I would love to see promotion and relegation in baseball. And every time people are asked about it in the press who are working in baseball, they act like it's the worst thing that could possibly happen to the sport. I think it would save the sport.
I think it would be delightful. I mean, I think that there's probably, you know, the way that the business is set up now where it's so dependent on TV stuff or whatever, like, suddenly if, like, Scranton Wilkes-Barre is suddenly in the major leagues, awesome. That would really scramble some, you know, but at the same time, like, yeah, deal with it. That's great.
Yeah. Kick the Knicks down to the D League. I mean, it would completely over the long term, it would make being a Knicks fan so much more alluring because they would have to do something proactive to stay in the league and just get their act together.
As somebody that is not a hard, you know, hardcore soccer fan, I've always found the English leagues system, like, where there's all of these different leagues and teams moving up and down between them, like, that sort of, like, the weirdly variegated experience that you can have as a fan of, like, a team in a small city or whatever, where, like, maybe your owner is, like, a socialist, or, like, also maybe your owner is, like, the weird industrial fascist. Yeah. Or is the town itself. Yeah. Right. But, like, any of that, I think that this is, like, broadly speaking, like, if I had, like, one really deeply felt opinion about sports, it's that, like, I like them more when they're weird, you know, that I want as many different experiences as I can get in watching something. And if that means, like, stylistic contrasts, different approaches, different, you know, ways of being a fan and being an organization, like, anywhere I can get more of that, I want more of that.
Yeah. No, I absolutely love it. I mean, the team I follow in Italy, it's from a town called Sassuolo that has 30,000 people. Some local, like, he owns, like, the equivalent of Home Depot in Italy. And he bought the team maybe 15, 20 years ago and rode it up from the D League all the way up to the top level. And they're a mid-table team that, you know, they just beat the second place team, you know, a couple of weeks ago. They're going to stay in the league. They're going to spend more money next year. And, you know, it's fun as hell. I mean, so
I think if Sassuolo is where I think it is, I studied near there.
Really?
And I, my friends and I have,
wait, well then.
Yeah. So we were in, near Reggio Emilia. So it's, is it?
Yeah.
It, so that's Emilia Romagna.
Yeah. Yeah. It's right between, Modena and Bologna.
Yeah. All right. So that is where I studied in the town called Scandiano. And my Italian is entirely gone, but, I had a great time there. When my friend told me that Sassuolo had become a power there, like, that was not one of the more glamorous stops on the train that took you.
It's not.
and the train that took you to the train that took you places. Like, it was not like the one that, you know, the idea of like getting out and being like, ah, Sassuolo, I'm going to visit, you know, whatever their famous, whatever it like rice processing facility. Like,
that
it's all
room.
Yeah. Emilia Romagna whips ass though. And not enough good things can happen to that region for me.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's just, yeah, it reminds me of like conversations I've had. Like, I really love, I mean, I don't think it's a top shelf product at all. And I think Americans would do a lot better in the soccer world if they understood their place in the soccer world a lot better. But that said, I am a Red Bulls fan, and I love going to the games in Newark. You know, they're just fun as hell.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, one time I was in the standing section, you know, talking with, you know, some kid who flew over from like Northern England to check out a game. And we're like, oh, cool. So like, what Prem League team do you support? And he was like, nah, I'm not in Prem. It's too much money. It sucks. I was like, oh, okay, who are you for? And he's like, well, we're in like the equivalent of like the C League. You know, again, it was a town of like 20,000 people that like, you know, he had tattoos. He was wearing their colors. Like, he was just like, absolutely, like, this was his life and existence. And I mean, the teams, as you mentioned, like, they have political connotations, they have class connotations, like all kinds of stuff. And like, he was just, you know, repping some town I've never heard of in Northern England. Like, it was, you know, he was a Bulls fan or a Cowboys fan. I think it's a tremendously fascinating aspect of sport that I'd like to see more of in America. But given where we are as a society, I'm not sure we're going to get promotion or relegation. I mean, we can't even get promotion or relegation in the MLS.
Yeah. I mean, but even beyond like promotion and relegation, like, again, like something that like a more local experience of it, like MLB threatening the existence of minor league baseball, just again, to save a few million dollars a year in a sport where teams make nine figure profits is embarrassing. Like that again, like minor league baseball is about as close as you can get to that sort of like whatever the league below the like the Champions League.
Mm-hmm.
thing in England, you know, but like there are teams in small American cities. People do care about them. You can get to the game for, you know, $10 or whatever. And like MLB pulling the plug on that to me would be like impossibly short-sighted.
Yeah. I think someone told me that second tier league, and I think we're both blanking on the name. I think it's Champion League in England. It's the second level.
Champion is under the Premiership, right?
Right. Someone told me that if that was spun out and if it was his own league, it would be like, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but like it was equivalent to like the NHL. It makes an enormous amount of money. And I'm sure plenty of McKinsey and Bain consultants have told Major League Baseball that if they did something like that with AAA, it would unlock a tremendous amount of value and help them get so much market share vis-a-vis other pro sports in the United States if they were to do something like that. But yeah, I mean, I get it. The culture is just one which doesn't allow people to think outside the box in Major League Baseball.
I mean, it's basically the same thing that they were trying to do when negotiating to bring the season back, which is like they have a number in mind. And then there's like a number of different ways that you can get to that total. But the total is fixed.
Yeah.
And so in this case, it's like they're willing to pay players a living wage if they reduce the number of players such that the actual cost remains the same.
Yeah.
Which is stupid, you know, like, because it's one of the things that's fun about baseball is sometimes you draft a guy in the fucking 64th round and he turns out to be Mike Piazza. Like, you take that off the table for yourself, or you make it so that that person has to like basically pay for no money someplace else. Like, you're hurting the sport. And also, you know, what if we didn't get Mike Piazza? The guy's hair was incredible.
yeah, I guess the theme of this segment is people do a lot of dumb shit out there. David, before I let you go, I have to ask, are you guys bringing back the name of the year segment on the podcast? Please say yes.
Very proud to say yes. Okay, cool. We talked to Stefan, and he has already announced on Twitter that Defector will be the home of the 2021 name of the year bracket. And of course we'll be doing, I mean, like, this has been the fun part about bringing back, you know, the, you know, it's not going to be the same as Deadspin, but to have all of us together and to have people be asking, you know, is Drew going to do the William Sonoma catalog? Are you going to be able to do something like remembering some guys? Are you going to be able to do the name of the year thing? And man, just being able to say yes to all of that, because it's like, it's not, you know, owned by our previous ownership. It feels incredible. Like, it feels great that people care, but also, like, I really love doing that work, man. So yeah, being able to go back and do it again is exciting in the extreme.
That's awesome. And while you said yes, I'm going to press my luck here and ask one more question. Yes. I was upset that Mike Diaper wasn't in last year's tournament. I feel like if you win a tournament, you should get automatically re-entered into the next tournament. Can you bring Mike Diaper back?
We're gonna look into it. We're gonna bring Mike Diaper back very strongly. I feel like it's tough because with a guy like, well, take a contender like Mike Diaper, right? when Mike Diaper is Mike Diaper, that's the more Francesa voice for me. But that name would just win every year. Like, at some point, you have to just say, you know, that, like, Dr. Narwhal's mating has had a good run, and now you're in the Hall of Fame, and you got to make room for other people.
Oh, God. It's such a simple bit, but it plays so well. I'm so glad it's coming
back. Mike Diaper, Pope Thrower was another. There's always one that, like, and it's not even always the funniest one that just basically reduces the podcast to, like, me and Drew having a giggle off. Looking forward to doing that shit again, too, yeah. Actually.
I mean, hey, I mean, maybe some of the losers that got dumped out in early rounds that people are still angry over. Like, I mean, Storm Duck could have another run at it. Like, Storm Duck, I feel like he got jilted.
Yeah, I think that would actually be, if you didn't, like, advance up the bracket and then you wanted to, like, I don't know, show up with, like, the Robert De Niro Cape Fear tattoos 2 years later, ready to kick ass.
How many source? So, okay, I should explain this to my listeners. So what these guys did every year, they would basically take an NCAA bracket, and instead of having college basketball teams face off and kind of a pyramid and, you know, get to the Final Four and then an ultimate winner. They basically had a team of people submit fake names that...
No, real names.
Sure. Real names, were attached to fictional players. And
no, these are real names of real people that appear in the news. I'm serious. Did you not know that?
No.
They're real. That's how you get into it. Is that these are names of, like, people. So this is what's kind of funny about looking up some of this stuff, is that sometimes it's like, oh, this guy's a defensive back at, like, a small college. And then sometimes it's like, this person is a carjacker. But, like, you have to get in the newspaper in order to make it into the name of the year bracket.
I love it. So yeah. How many people source names for you guys?
So it's like, it takes a village, Lee. It's like, seriously, thousands of people submitting, you know, names to, like, it's run through Stefan Fatsis.
I can't believe I just Googled this. There is a dude named Storm Duck. He plays for North Carolina.
Yeah. This is what's so good about it, is to look it up. I mean, in some cases, it's like Dr. Narwhal's mating is a real person, but they change their name just because they love narwhals so much or whatever. But some of them, like, you'll see it and just sort of, like, Pope Thrower is like a spokesperson for the GOP in Tennessee or something like that.
How did I not know this?
So this is what makes it, like, so much more Holy exciting crap. To me, is that, like, the names as they come in, and, you know, I don't get that many because I'm not as closely associated with it. Stefan Fatsis from Slate is basically the moving force behind it. But people will DM me sometimes and be like, just like a link and a name, or they'll be like, did you know about somebody named D'Artagnan Fosbury? And I'll be like, no, I didn't. Thank you. And then I'll just, like, forward that to the authorities.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Mind blown. So I'm obviously unable to continue with this interview because I've just had...
Yeah, if you need to lie down, that's fine. This is normal.
Blown onto
normal.
The walls of my house. Okay, cool. David, thank you. Thank you so much for your time today. Very illuminating discussion. Really appreciate it. And best of luck going forward. Everyone, run to the website and subscribe. Help support these guys.
Thank you very much, man. I appreciate it.
That's David Roth. Be sure to check out his stuff when Defector launches in coming weeks. After the break, Eric Fagelding is back on the show to talk COVID-19. You're listening to Nights and Weekends, back after this.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager, Learning the Lingo.
GOAT, G-O-A-T, acronym, stands for Greatest of All Time, as in spaghetti sandwiches for dinner,
They're my fave. Dad, you're the GOAT.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
So as I said at the top, Eric Fagelding is an epidemiologist and health economist serving as a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists. We had him on the show a couple weeks back to talk about COVID-19 and the difficulties we seem to be having as a society in terms of communicating what is happening and what we can do to help stop the spread of the virus. We wanted to bring him back on the show to talk about some new studies that are making their way around the media, not only to understand what they mean, but also to critique how the government and the press are doing their jobs in terms of messaging this crisis. Eric, welcome back. How's it going?
I'm good. Hope everyone's doing well.
Likewise. So you've just been hitting the cover off the ball when it comes to curating news and research related to COVID for us all on Twitter. Last time we had you on the show, we talked about the WHO coming under pressure to come out and just say that the virus is much more airborne than previously believed. And the conversation really came down to the seeming inability for government, media, and the scientific community just to get on the same page and message this the right way to the public. We wanted to have you back on the show to talk about this confluence of studies we're seeing, one of which was the aerosol study on the Diamond Princess cruise ship. Can you talk to us a little bit about what these studies mean and why does this story and other studies like it need to be prominent on everyone's radar?
Yeah, I think the conversation has evolved so much and there's still resistance, but I think the people are waking up to the fact that this is a very infectious airborne virus. Now, some people don't like the word airborne, but and they prefer the word aerosol, but let's be honest, an aerosol is airborne because a lot of the transmission now, we used to think it's used to be like this hand washing, touch a dirty handle, or it's coughing. And if you're within someone's 6 feet, that you could catch someone's cough. That's large droplets, which is ballistic style, as in it pulls down to the ground by gravity. But aerosols stay in the air for anywhere from 20 minutes to 4 hours to 16 hours, in stagnant air, and it potentially survives that long too. And so the latest studies seem to indicate that not only do these hover in the air, but they're also infectious in the air. And so that's actually what some scientists did. They actually grabbed air samples from a hospital ward, okay, and not within 6 feet of anyone, just grabbed it from the air. And they actually then try to see, okay, this air sample from this hospital COVID ward, can it infect people? And lo and behold, it infected cells and it replicated in cells. So we know this virus is stable in the air and can replicate and beyond just 6 feet. So that is showing that the 6 feet rule is not sufficient. This distancing is not sufficient, especially indoors. And we have to rethink everything from ventilation to so many things. And the newest study from the Diamond Princess, they think that most of the transmission on Diamond Princess was actually through aerosols, through the air in the aerosols, which is very disturbing because the ship actually has decent ventilation of anything because it's, you know, it has windows. But we know that this air transmission, that even if someone was in a room and left, there are residual aerosols that they leave, such as in a bathroom, could still be infectious. And this just caused a whole boatloads of problems that we have not been prepared for before.
Yeah, I mean, it's disturbing because the disease is no doubt terrible, but we're finding ourselves as a society constantly trying to recalibrate what our precautions should be and just coming to terms with understanding this disease seems to be an iterative process that's taking a long time. So if it's airborne, do we all need goggles now? I'm watching a video from last week of Fox News host Laura Ingraham. She's putting on a ski mask at the end of her recent show, mocking Dr. Fauci's comments on eye protection. Is this just going to be another battle in the culture war where information is processed rigidly according to your political tribe?
Yeah, I think this tribalism is really crazy. And Fauci's comment was that we may need guidelines for eye protection in the future. And so just so you know, in the hospitals, it is already standard practice guidelines that every ICU doctor and nurse needs eye protection. That's already pretty clear. You already see doctors wearing eye goggles and face shields. And so that is already known protocol. The issue is, should we issue a public protocol, right? A public guideline for not just hospital doctors and healthcare workers. This is where it becomes, well, kind of maybe. Because is there a risk? Yes. We know that the mucosa of your eyes, just like the mucosa of your throat and your nose, can be an infectious route. And we've seen that before. And so Fauci basically then said, you know, if you want to be fully protected, do it. Do you probably need it most of the time? No. But if you want to be fully protected. So he acknowledges its risk. It's possible. It can certainly happen. If you want maximum protection, then do it. But issuing public guidelines, you know, we can't even, we're having wars over masks right now between the left and the right. Imagine if we had to put on guidelines for face shields and goggles. Personally, I think face shields are very, in certain ways, face shields are very inexpensive, right? And they're easy to manufacture. And they're, I think they could actually be much more readily accessible. Now, goggles, you know, it's a different, it's seriously, it's a different degree. But I honestly, you know, I always, the reason I share information is I want to put people on the most precautious stance, because there is a precautionary principle. And had we all taken a precautionary principle back in January when people were saying, oh, there's no human-to-human transmission. Oh, it's just from, you know, touching things, you know, and don't touch your nose and stuff like that. Had we been more cautious, we would have been way more prepared, right? Mm-hmm. And this is why, you know, Fauci acknowledges risk. And I think we do need a public guideline. But God forbid, you know, Laura Ingraham or the right wing is, I know for certain, going to go ballistic when these public guidelines come out. And I think they should, to be honest.
Yeah. And I mean, we're not even talking about anything in the realm of mandatory here. It's just guidelines. If people want to get advice on how to keep themselves safe, it's crazy that we're even having this conversation, but you know, that's where we are in August of 2020. Let me ask you, is it a problem that news of these studies hits the press before these studies go into peer review? How should we balance the speed of disclosure versus normal due diligence?
Yeah, I think peer review, the old traditional ways of peer review, sometimes peer review, just so you know, it takes like a month or two. I've had papers, I've published a lot of papers before, and sometimes the peer review, honestly, it's, I had one paper was take 6 months. Peer review is, in a normal, old, traditional scientific process, good, and you know, slow is okay, slow and steady. But in certain ways, as Dr. Mike Ryan of WHO says, if you have to be certain and you have to, if you want to only act when you know you're absolutely right, you will lose against this virus. Mm-hmm. And so obviously it creates a little fog in which not every paper is peer reviewed. And just so you know, even when it's peer reviewed, there can be junk. But I think when an article comes out, there's quickly consensus consolidating. This makes sense. This does not make sense, right? And oftentimes journalists do try to interview as many experts as possible to see, okay, does this make sense? Like, is this bunk? Is this legit? So that's a kind of like a instantaneous peer review that journalists do by interviewing many experts at the same time. And so I think the move fast, get the information out, check the information with many experts, and then writing an article, I think it's just as reliable these days as the old traditional ways of peer review, which I'll be honest, has a lots of politics of so-and-so scientist doesn't like that scientist. So if it lands on their desk, they're going to trash it. Mm-hmm. So peer review is not perfect. I think the information right now, the filtering system we have, it is as good as it gets, but I always say we should always lean towards precaution. And I think some of the community like not all the virology community has come around to aerosols, but the, because aerosol comes from like the environmental health, you know, aerosols of smoke, cigarette smoke, aerosols of these popcorn factory vapors. The evidence is building so strongly, and Fauci even acknowledges he needs to discuss aerosol with the coronavirus task force because it's becoming a really serious problem.
It's wild to think about the repercussions for society if it turns out that this virus can exist airborne for longer periods of time than we realized. I mean, are large skyscrapers that have these huge HVAC systems, are they going to have to, you know, retool their air conditioning systems? Are elevator companies going to have to retool their hardware? I mean,
well, I think building ventilation, you can actually take in more fresh air each time instead of recycling all the air. I think they have to add much more UV light desanitization sanitization systems in all the HVAC. I have it in my personal HVAC. In environmental health, there's a saying, the solution to pollution is dilution or ventilation. And that's honestly, for schools, that's what we need to do. Actually, in Israel, the outbreak was because everything was okay until there was a heat wave. And then they closed all the windows to turn on the air conditioning. And there was, it was so hot that they waived the mask rule. So in those 4 days in which they waived the mask rule, closed the windows with poor ventilation, that's when the epidemic spread like wildfire.
Wow.
And this is why it's so critical for schools to have ventilation, and interior classrooms should be honestly not used anymore. And the hardest thing, though, of course, is bathrooms. Bathrooms, anytime you flush a toilet, that's an aerosol-generating device. And most of our public bathrooms do not have toilet lids, which are kind of like masks for toilets, right?
Huh.
So I think bathrooms, I think, need the most redesigning of all in the coming near wave.
What you're telling me is a lot of money is going to have to be spent for people or organizations that own large buildings.
Yeah, absolutely. Or even small buildings. I think all bathrooms, think about airport bathrooms, how crowded they are. These hand washing things, you know, that circulate, blow your air. If anything that's actually really bad because it blows things all throughout the room. It's just that the airflow is one of the worst problems that we have not really addressed.
Wow.
And the aerosol thing just exacerbates it.
Wild. Eric, since we last spoke, are you noticing improvement in how government and media are able to message critical information about COVID, at least in the United States? Or is this still a goat rodeo in your view? Are we trending more positive or more negative since we last spoke?
I think the information is improving. But at the same time, the misinformation is also growing. Like, we have channels in which we try to communicate people, like for coronavirus, it's kind of established now. But at the same time, the CDC being kneecapped and muzzled from their hospital data, you know, CDC has been collecting these weekly hospital data for 15 years in their system. It's a smooth machine. But now, all of a sudden, they, you know, them being kneecapped from the data and being forcing all hospitals to divert the data to a private contractor, which is not automated in any way, and actually is even more complicated. Actually, in the middle of a pandemic, that's the worst thing that can happen right now. And that is just completely unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And but we still have really ragtag reporting in terms of cases. You know, the CDC, you know, COVID tracking project has become the de facto CDC of testing or reporting, because CDC just doesn't report fast enough. They don't report on weekends. And it's just woefully behind. In certain ways, CDC should be having a press conference every single day, but they're not. Mm-hmm. Instead of the president. And of course, his press conferences are just an utter mess. You know, just the Axios interview in which the reporter, Jonathan Swan, had to remind him and teach him about denominators is just so glaring. And I think there's still so much misinformation. And also, by the way, the vaccine misinformation, that's actually growing. Like, we're analyzing the anti-vaxxer movement has been growing, and that's actually a really bad sign, even when we potentially get a vaccine.
Yeah, I saw a poll released earlier this morning about attitudes towards a vaccine should it come out. And it was interesting the way they asked the question, you know, will you take the vaccine once it's available? Yes, no, or not sure. And then they asked the sub question, how quickly will you move to get vaccinated once it's available? And the numbers were really, there were a lot of people in the unsure category. I'd say it was over 25%. And not a lot of people wanted the vaccine immediately, which, look, I understand. I'm not an anti-vaxxer by any means. I want the vaccine when it's available. But do I want to be first in line? It's going to take some measure of courage to be that person.
Personally, I would get in line. You know, this is me. Because the vaccine technology that we have now is so much better than what we used to have, like these either live attenuated or these inactivated viruses. But now we actually have much more better vectors, the mRNA or the adenovirus vector that carries a tag of the virus. So your body, it's a training program. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's how what a vaccine is. It's a training program for the actual virus should you encounter it. I think they're much better, but obviously we need the testing for sure. We definitely need the testing for sure. But I think people's anxiety should be much lower than what it is. It's been built up, but I think in time, I think my motto for the public is trust Fauci. Because Fauci is not a political appointee. Fauci cannot be fired by the president. And he works for the NIH Research Institutes, which he's been heading the infectious disease division for decades. At the end of the day, trust Fauci. I think that is the ultimate mantra.
In Fauci, we trust. Eric, yeah. I dig it. Thank you so much for coming back on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Stay safe.
You too.
That's Eric Fagel-Ding. Guys, do yourself a favor and go follow him on Twitter. He's at Dr. Eric Ding. And that's the show. We are produced by Connor Lynch. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the show. We'd love it if you could give us a good review, or even better, help sponsor the program through the link in the heading. If you have any comments, guest or topic suggestions, or just want to tee off, hit me up at lee@nightsandweekends.com. That's L-E-E at N-I-T-E-S-W-K-N-D-S.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.